CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, it's me, Finn, here to remind you of my show.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is the leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council and the councillor for St George West, Peter Hammond. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, this show is always fishing for corruption, so the news of the world phone hacking crimes have opened a can of worms. A criminal conspiracy between News International and Scotland Yard is on the cards at the heart of the government, and it's now plain to see, while the perpetrators remain at large, it undermines the rule of law. But way back in 2000, two investigative journalists at the Guardian Investigations Unit were digging out stories of police corruption, and they were forced to leave the paper because the editor wouldn't print the stories. The editor caved in to pressure from the very police force they were investigating. These shocking revelations were finally published in a book, The Untouchables: Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, back in 2004. And I got their take on the hacking scandal yesterday. Plus, we have 60 million acres of land in Britain and about 60 million people, but over the centuries it's been robbed from the many by the few. And now most of us don't have any land at all. Even if you have a mortgage, it's actually the bank that owns your land. But the greedy landowners' days are numbered. Frank White's going to be reclaiming the fields next weekend, and he'll be along in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20, fairly sunny on Saturday, but wetter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 23 Celsius, feeling muggy, with some sunshine at the beginning of the week, wetter towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of August, highs again around 20 Celsius, fairly sunny and dry. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and we'll start with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, first of all, is it possible that the euro and the dollar, both looking a bit dicey at the moment, could they collapse at the same time?
They could, and of course, if one collapses, it may encourage people to sell the other. I mean, one thing that might happen, of course, is that people would buy the euro if the dollar collapses and vice versa, but it may be that they just begin to decide that all of these fiat currencies, as they're called, ones that are not based on gold, are not worth having, and then we get a full-scale panic.
So are there currencies around the world you can invest in that are actually based on gold?
The Libyan gold dinar? Would you
well,
believe?
I don't know about the Libyan gold dinar, no. I think that's you can't invest in that anymore, can
well,
you?
Well, no, because there's sanctions on Libya, but I mean, that's possibly one of the reasons why there are sanctions on Libya.
What about the yuan, the Chinese currency, or the ruble, the Russians?
Yeah, well, you could, but I mean, the yuan is linked to the dollar anyway. It's absolutely pegged to the dollar, so if the dollar collapses, the yuan collapses. Basically, there's a real threat to the whole fiat money system.
But what does fiat money mean?
Fiat money means, a fiat means a decree, so... basically, it means that...
this is Latin, I guess.
Yes, and it just means that basically this money is decreed to be... I mean, basically, you know, a pound note is, or a pound coin is not worth a pound. It's a token that's worth a pound, if you see what I'm driving at. Traditionally, historically, you know, a pound was a pound of gold. You know, that's how it started off. But, of course, it's no longer worth a pound of gold at all.
It's not worth a pound of gold anymore,
is
it? No,
it's definitely not. And basically, that's not necessarily a problem, because as long as everybody accepts that the money... It's like IOUs circulate and so on, there's no problem. But of course, if people lose confidence in the money and then start selling it, then others lose confidence, because of course the money starts to lose its value, whether it's the dollar or the euro or anything else, and then you get a full-on panic which pulls everything down, because you have to raise interest rates at that point to try and protect the currency, and in doing that you crush the economy under a steamroller, basically.
So did we sow the seeds for this disaster when we came off the gold standard? I think that was just before the Second World War.
No, the real scene for this disaster was in 1971, when the dollar was taken off gold.
So it doesn't matter if the pound isn't attached
to gold. Everything is related to the dollar as the world's reserve currency, and the world's reserve currency, the dollar, was then linked to gold, in theory. But of course, the Americans or the US government started abusing their position and printing more dollars than they had gold for. And eventually, in order to fight the Vietnam War, they wanted to fight the Vietnam War without having to pay for it. And they started printing dollars effectively to pay for it. And General de Gaulle and others arrived at Fort Knox, or their representatives arrived at Fort Knox, and started changing their dollars into gold. And all the gold was being run out of Fort Knox and ending up in France and other places. And at that point, Nixon took the dollar off gold, which allowed the Americans to print as many dollars as they liked and allowed them to fight the Vietnam War on tick. And they've been fighting all their wars on tick ever since. And now, of course, the red bill is coming home. And I don't mean the red blood bill, I mean the red money bill.
The only trouble is, I mean, this money, isn't it possible for them to just take out more and more debt? That's what they're going to be deciding on the second.
You can always carry on taking out debt, but at what point do people lose confidence in your ability to repay it? That's the issue.
Okay, so that's what they'd be deciding, is it, on the 2nd of August? Because there's a lot of talk about the 2nd of August as a deadline.
It's a self-inflicted deadline. I mean, frankly, they could easily raise more money on the debt markets if they wanted to. The Republicans don't really want to. Therefore, they're prematurely creating a crisis. They probably could carry on printing money a bit longer without much, I mean, they've printed so much already, a little bit more probably wouldn't make that much difference one way or the other.
So why are some Republicans holding out and saying, no, you can't lift the debt ceiling anymore?
Because they're economically illiterate, partly, and secondly, because they really don't understand the consequences of what they're doing. I mean, frankly, they do need to get the deficit down, and to do that they've got to basically withdraw from the 173 bases they've got around the world and finish fighting in all of these wars. It'll still have cost them a fortune, but they've got to stop spending that money right now. Basically, ultimately, the United States cannot afford to have its military in the state it's in at the moment. It just can't, unless the wealthy are prepared to stump up the money. If the wealthy want to pay, you see, in the good old days, the wealthy classes who started wars had to pay for them as well. But what's happened with the printing of money is they can have their wars, but they don't have to pay for them. But at a certain point, that cannot go on.
But the Americans aren't going to give up their bases. There's military bases all around the world.
Well, in that case, they'll have to give up the dollar then, as the world's reserve currency. It's one or the other.
So what will be the world's reserve currency if not the dollar?
Gold.
So, but gold is not a currency which is traded in an ordinary way.
Doesn't matter. I mean, the point is that gold is already pushing upwards as we speak. There's all sorts of manipulations of the market by the Plunge Protection Team and other sort of semi-government agencies in the US. The Federal Reserve engages in market manipulation. They're manipulating the gold price downwards as much as they can. But ultimately, a gold spike is what you get in the middle of a crash. And that's what will happen, as in 1929. Everybody will rush for gold. And when they do that, the world economy crashes out.
So it's just simply a matter of confidence. There's much more confidence now in gold than there is in the dollar.
Well, confidence in gold is not confidence in nothing, really, because gold doesn't do anything. It's useless. It has no industrial uses. So when people grab gold, it means that they've given up on the economy and they just want, you know, something safe to put their assets into.
Now, last week we were talking about if you do have some savings, that actually it could be possibly a good thing to do to invest in gold. But it's not actually much point in taking your money out of the bank, putting it into gold, and then leaving it, that gold, at the bank in a safe deposit box, is it?
Yes. I mean, the gold can't disappear unlike electronic numbers. But of course, if the bank's door is locked and they won't let you in, then you've got a bit of a problem, haven't you?
So does that mean, you know, literally sort of putting it under your mattress or squirreling it away somewhere?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that is what happens in a crash, is that people try to get liquidity, as it's called, yeah? They want stuff that will definitely be wanted by others. And of course, the other thing besides gold is you might want to buy, I don't know, weapons or food or oil. Something physical.
What about silver? I mean, that's
silver. Silver would do. But gold tends to be a good buy in a crash because everybody rushes for gold, and that pushes the price up. Yeah, so you might even make money on buying gold, if you see what I mean, because as the price rises and others pile in behind you.
But to what extent is this a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where people start talking about a crash, talking about, you know, this sort of debt defaulting and these kinds of things, and that actually can encourage it to happen?
That is indeed the case. And George Osborne has been doing that for the last year and a half, telling us we can't afford this, we can't afford that, we're on the brink of bankruptcy. All of which was very silly for a Chancellor of the Exchequer to be saying, in my view. That's not what you'd paid for, to tell everybody to panic, which is effectively what they've done. And now they're surprised that the economy's stalled. I mean, it was bound to stall, wasn't it? Because you've been talking it down for a year and a half.
Okay, now, just on this same subject, we've got US writer and filmmaker Bill Still. He thinks the debt ceiling, this is what's being decided next Tuesday, the 2nd of August, should not be raised in the US. Instead, that the government should bite the bullet and take back control of the dollar from the private banks. Now, before we just hear from Bill Still, Martin, what's your thoughts on that idea of the government, actually the US Treasury, taking over control of the dollar from the private banks?
That's a very good idea, but it won't happen because the private banks have got too much political power.
So maybe Bill Steele is being a little bit idealistic, but let's hear what he has to say anyway.
I completely agree with not raising the debt limit, but probably for different reasons than the Republicans. Sovereign nations do not have to borrow money. They can create it. They should create it. And if they intend to remain sovereign, they must create it. You see, there are only two choices in this big bad world of sovereign nations. You can let your elected government create the money completely in the public interest, completely debt-free, or you inevitably, in one way or another, give that power away to the banks. There is no other choice. When the big bankers get control of the money system, as they have since the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, then they will inevitably centralize the wealth of the nation into few hands, their hands. That's why bank buildings are the biggest in every city on this planet. But it doesn't have to be this way. History has shown time and time again that nations can be wealthy and stable without any debt whatsoever. After all, if you had a money printing machine in your basement that was legal to use and you wanted to go out and build a new house, would you go borrow the money from a bank or would you print it in your basement? What the U.S. is doing by raising the debt ceiling is allowing the sale of more government bonds, which carry interest and are purchased primarily by the biggest banks, including central banks. Now, if that isn't bad enough, these big banks don't actually have any money. They just make it up by typing numbers into their computers. Then they use these made-up numbers to buy government bonds, and we then have to pay them interest. Yep, that's how it's done. Thomas Jefferson identified this problem nearly 200 years ago. In 1815, Jefferson wrote to then-President Monroe, "The dominion of the banks must be broken or it will break us."
That was Bill Still there, who's a filmmaker. His latest film is called The Secret of Oz, and it's all about the money system and how it all works. But Martin Summers, I mean, is he being a bit idealistic there, saying, look, we're going to have to stop raising this debt ceiling at some point, and the government, the Treasury, has simply got to bite the bullet?
Well, I think I agree with that in one way. I mean, of course, they need to completely reform the financial system. That should have happened years ago. But if they don't raise the debt ceiling next Tuesday, you're then immediately going to have a crisis potentially of global proportions. Now, that may then lead to the necessary political will to change the financial structure. So it's a very high risk strategy. It might be better to just kick the can down the road just one more time and then think of something a bit more serious. Than you know, the crisis itself is forcing the issue, and that may be good, but we really need an orderly unwinding of the power of the private banks, rather than a big bang.
What you're saying is, don't bite the bullet this time, bite it next time.
Yes, because biting it this time when you're not ready is asking for trouble, isn't it? You're not prepared, you've got no plan B or plan C, so you've got to be pretty cautious. We're actually on a tightrope, and falling off the tightrope is not a good idea.
Okay, well, let's hope that we're now going to talk to the man with the plan B and with the plan C. That's Peter Hammond. Welcome to Drive Time, Peter.
Good evening. I'm not quite sure whether I've got plans B, C, D or E, but we'll see where we go.
Okay, well, let's start by asking you about Ed Miliband, who's had his bit of plastic surgery or whatever it is this week, because the phone hacking inquiry chief, the chief judge of this, Judge Levinson, has been taking favours from the Murdochs, brother-in-law Matthew Freud, and partying with him. But Ed has had nothing to say about this because he's having plastic surgery. So with the Labour Party's not fit for opposition, let alone government.
Oh, I think that's a bit cruel, really, that is. I mean, actually, I've got a bit of sympathy with Ed Miliband, because I suffer from the same problem, not sleep apnea, but his bent nose. I've got exactly the same problem, but I like to think it leads to part of my charm and good looks.
But shouldn't he have sort of stepped sideways and let someone else deal with this? Because, I mean, the judge that's going to be in charge of this phone hacking inquiry clearly is very pally with and has been accepting favours from the family, Murdoch... its immediate family, so that seems like he's really not the right man for the job, even before he started with this inquiry.
Well, I mean, I'll be blunt, and like everybody else, you look at the individuals involved either in the investigation or in the, you know, original allegations of phone hacking, and it's actually quite a small select group of people when you look at it in terms of society. I'm not surprised that, you know, a judge has had, if you like, social contacts with people in the media in any shape or form, because that's the nature of life. Now, I'm not saying it's right, but we're all surprised by it, and I don't think that's really the right attitude to take.
Isn't it quite a coincidence, though, that we've got the judge who, this judge happens to be pally with the Murdoch's family, and yet he's supposed to be investigating them? Well, it's just the same old thing again, isn't it? There's no way he's going to find, or he can be unbiased in such a report. Surely he should just step aside and let someone else do it.
Well, you know, my personal opinion is that, A, it's going to be difficult to find somebody who's not potentially tainted, but certainly in principle, I think we've got to find somebody who is not, and to be able to carry out this inquiry, you know, with some degree of acceptance, shall we say, by you, me and everybody in the street, that there's no potential evidence of any, shall we say, friendly associations in the past. And that is a problem, basically. If you go through the whole judiciary, I expect that somebody at some time or other has had a cup of tea with somebody highly questionable in the past. That's part of the nature of the judiciary, I'm afraid.
The thing is, it's not just a cup of tea, is it? It's Matthew Freud offering having his services accepted for the judge. I mean, but Matthew Freud runs a public relations agency, and the judge has accepted favours from this public relations agency who will be working for him on a pro bono basis. I mean, it seems like it's actually a financial twist to this, as well as just being pally. You know, they're not just sitting around having drinks together.
Well, I think, you know, like you, I think it's highly questionable. And when you consider, you know, what went on in Scotland Yard, you know, people being employed, you know, through the police that had, if you like, financial advantage as a result of that employment, I think that the whole system does need some opening up and be able to, let's have some daylight shed on what's going on in these circles. And I agree with everybody else that's saying it's highly questionable, and really we should be taking a proper look at what's going on.
Well, let's see if we can find a High Court judge around Bristol area that hasn't got some sort of too pally relationship with Matthew Freud or Rupert Murdoch.
Not anyway, in my social circles, I'm afraid.
You are the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, and I noticed in the newspaper yesterday, Peter, you had a piece saying that, which is quite shocking really, saying that we could be facing millions of pounds more cuts in the city. Can you just explain why you're saying that?
Well, it's very simple. The council has currently owned up to the fact that they're £4.2 million overspent, or so they think they will be, at the end of the year, despite the cuts that they've implemented. That is serious. One is what is going on. Why are, you know, only a few months into the year are they predicting they're going to overspend, having made some pretty nasty reductions in expenditure, as they would call it. But it's very significant in the fact that in order to make it up, they're going to have to chop something else. And that's the real problem there. 4.2 million is a serious figure that, you know, we're suffering from. And that's plus whatever else that is being dreamt up for next year, which is another £21 million worth. So £21 million worth next year, if they don't, inverted commas, put it right, will be £26 million worth to be chopped next year.
Now, you're obviously a lot closer to this kind of financial stuff than we are. Can you tell us why it is that there are such lax budgetary controls on the way that money is spent, that they can be the £4 million overspent?
Well, I wish I could tell you. But we have a serious problem at the moment in that it is very difficult, even for us somewhere near the centre, we're not in charge of the place, to actually get facts and information out of the system.
But we have a scrutiny committee system, don't we, where that is supposed to take place?
Yes, but I think the public should go along to scrutiny commissions, and not through the lack of questioning by councillors on people's behalf. It's just that the information is not available. They're working on something that they'll bring forward in September, and they'll let us know. And it's really serious in that even we, that, you know, perhaps have slightly more access to information, when we ask questions, we can't get answers either. This council at this particular point in time is extremely secretive in what it's doing. It's not consulting with people potentially affected, and it's not letting people know before it's sort of announced with some sort of fanfare on the radio what they're up to. And but it's a serious question.
The Lib Dems would say exactly the same, Peter, about the Labour administration when Labour were running the city council, that the Labour were also played their cards very close to their chest.
There's a difference between playing the cards close to the chest and refusing to give information to councillors. And this isn't, in one sense, a party political thing, because I happen to know that councillors of all sorts of parties are asking questions and they're not getting any answers. I'm asking if you're going to have to make another £1.9 million worth of savings in either social care or young people, how are you doing it? What are you proposing to do? No answer.
Well, many people may actually be slapping the council on the back and saying, well, well done for standing up to Westminster and actually providing the services that people need rather than just bending over to the cuts.
Well, if you call potentially closing care homes, if you call potentially shutting day centres, if you call increasing Meals on Wheels charges, you know, a good job being done by the council, I think there's a lot of people around in Bristol who would sort of disagree with that particular view. And there was a phrase that was popular by the leader of my own party that was talking about the squeezed middle. It's not just the squeezed middle, it's the squeeze all of us at this point in time. And what's happening will get worse and worse and worse. And it's bad business and bad economic sense as well.
Well, what about the wealthy that don't use council services as much as others, poorer people that need it? Are they being squeezed too?
Well, everybody thinks that, you know, different people of different incomes don't use council services. But, you know, shall we say the slightly more affluent who allegedly don't use council services, their cars will go down the potholes in the same way as my, if you like, second-hand car goes down in the potholes. They'll be the people who potentially might have problems with their refuse collection in the future if there's problems. So they are paying for services as well as you and I, and potentially they are going to suffer when those services, if you like, reduce beyond an acceptable limit.
Now, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, I mean, you're both Labour people here, but can you give us an idea, Martin, of how Bristol's dilemma here, with this £5 million, it seems, overspend, roughly, fits in with the bigger picture in the rest of the world? Is it, do you think, possible that as the recovery picks up, then actually this won't matter because we will have the income, the tax income, to pay for it in the future?
Well, if the recovery picks up is the big if, isn't it? I mean, that's not what's happening in the bigger picture. This is quite possibly why Mr. Skidmore didn't want to come on our show today from the MP for Kingswood, because the economy is actually stalling and the deficit is actually increasing as a result of the fact that the economy is stalling, which was always absolutely predictable. And people have been telling the government this since they were elected, that this is what would happen. But they seem to be genuinely shocked by it, which I just think are going, "Ah, you're genuinely shocked. What did you think was going to happen when you push the cuts agenda through? The deficit's going to increase, and then you're going to lose the country's credit rating sometime in the autumn. And at that point, even if we've escaped the banking crisis, there will be a political crisis of enormous proportions in this country. I'm afraid we may even have a snap election as a result of this. I know we're not ready for it, but I don't think they're going to go the distance. They haven't really not understood how serious the situation is. They think that somehow they're going to muddle through. I don't think they are.
OK, thanks very much, Martin. Anyway, on to first of our stories. We're looking through our news review. And around about this time last week, it was people were just coming to terms with the horrific killings over in Norway. And the question I'm asking now is, was Norway's killer Anders Breivik a Freemason? Because there's a lot of pictures of him actually as a Freemason on the internet with his Masonic sash on and his Masonic apron. And one of the things that's been pointed out to to me that the Dunblane killer, Thomas Hamilton, this is up in Scotland about 10-15 years ago, was also a Freemason. Now, Martin, do you want to start on this? Because, I mean, I don't just want to talk about this, the fact that it may be a Masonic connection, but it's a pretty horrific thing, isn't it, to see that actually this is a far-right, it certainly appears to be, a far-right, neo-Nazi-style terror attack. Very different to what we were being told, particularly in the Murdoch newspapers, the Times and the Sun, last Saturday. Even the day after the attacks, we were still being told by these two Murdoch papers, and some other papers, it has to be said, that this was an Islamic terror attack. It now turns out it was nothing of the sort.
Well, it's an Islamophobic terror attack. I mean, if the ravings of this madman are to be believed. I mean, basically, what can one say? It's just a horrific, horrible event. When I saw the pictures of all those young people from the Labour Party Young Socialists in Norway who've been slaughtered out of hand, it must have been terrifying, because the guy was storming around for over an hour. People, you know, people knew they were going to die for over an hour. Horrific. But if it does nothing else, and it reminds people of how well-managed Norway has been over the last 50 years by the Labour Party, where they have an egalitarian society where I can find out, in Norway, you can find out exactly how much people are worth, because you can look at their tax return on the internet, and you can see how much people are worth. And it's a family society where they look after each other. They had oil, we had oil, they knew what to do with their oil. Statoil is one of the best managed public enterprises in the world. That's what Britain could and should have been. But we're not, are we?
Peter, what are your thoughts on the way this has all transpired? Initially, people were saying that this was kind of some kind of Islamic terror plot, actually on the Friday, and as I said, on the Saturday in some newspapers, still leading with Al-Qaeda attack, Norway's 9/11, these kind of headlines, about how it's all transpired. And it certainly does appear that this chap is a neo-Nazi, a Freemason, a completely new type, as so-called, of terrorist.
Well, I can remember when the first reports were coming through, and I actually saw on the, I can't remember which channel it was, it might have been on Sky News, when, you know, on the ticker tape bot thing at the bottom, it was, you know suggestions of an Al-Qaeda attack, and it, you know, I'm not an expert on these things, but it didn't look like even what was going on was an Al-Qaeda attack. Mm. And I think it's appalling that some sections of the media still persisted in, as Martin has said, this sort of Islamophobic approach to this horrific, and it's truly horrific, event. It's got some sort of resonance with me, because many years ago, far too many than I care to remember, I was in the, you know, Britain's equivalent of the Young Socialists, and you know, we had sort of camps and events, you know, similar to this. So it really does come home. The only one good thing about it is that potentially you could argue that it's actually had exactly the opposite effect than this lunatic, this nutcase, actually attempted to achieve. It's actually brought people together, and people who may not have been, how can I say, particularly sympathetic either to the, you know, the Norwegian Labour Party, or perhaps even to, you know, some of the changes in society that they may have, you know, felt challenged by. But it's had that incredible effect on people. But we've got to be aware of something, that everybody thinks, well, what a surprise that you've got this particular individual and his ideas. That's no surprise. Even in this country, we've had people like him from the extreme right prosecuted, arrested for bomb attacks, certainly the attack in the homophobic attack in London, by people of a similar outlook. So it's not, it's less usual than, shall we say, other attacks, but it's potentially something that's, there's an undercurrent even in British society at the moment. And I think that there are potential links to people in this country that, you know, people are denying. Mm. But there are very clear links of people of his thinking with elements in our society, I'm afraid.
I think the fact is, of course, if it had been a Muslim who'd carried out these attacks, all of those people who were critical of the war on terror and all the rest of it, we would all have been in the fray. Oh, you've created the environment in which these terrorists think they can operate like this. Now, those who were coming out with Islamophobic comments in the British media, and I think of people like Melanie Phillips, who was quoted in his blog, they should go away and examine their consciences, because they, of course, will be horrified by what's happened. But they have created the sea in which these fish swim. Yeah, the idea that Islamophobia is somehow a respectable kind of racism, because what we're really concerned about here is women's rights or something like this. And they've created a whole atmosphere in which these people think that they have got some justification for what are absolutely appalling acts. But I think also it will backfire, as Peter says, because I think the Norwegian people will stick together and will feel even more proud of everything that they've achieved in their country over the last 50 years. And I think it's a lesson to the rest of the world what they've done. In actual fact, they've got increasing numbers of people employed in manufacturing industry in Norway. How on earth do they do that? Well, they haven't got a free market philosophy. That's one of the reasons why they're not in the EU.
Now, one of the chief teams of people in Britain that is responsible for ensuring that we are protected against terrorist attacks of all sorts, of course, is the Metropolitan Police Anti-Terrorist Branch. And these are the same people that as we've seen recently with the phone hacking scandal, really failed to do a proper investigation into all the evidence that there was from the private investigator, Glenn Mulcair. So do you have confidence that the anti-terrorist police are going to be up to the job in Britain in actually changing their focus from looking at Islamic terrorism to also including this kind of neo-Nazi far-right terror?
Well, look, I mean, you and I do research these things pretty thoroughly, as you know. We both know about Gladio in the 70s and the 80s, where the British and the US and other intelligence services were involved in fomenting both right and left-wing terrorism in order to achieve political objectives. And the first question that crosses my mind when I see an incident like this, is he acting alone or is there something behind him? And if we find there's something behind him, I would expect the Norwegian police to go after whatever is there. But of course, there are always questions about the independence of the police force. We had a 30-year civil war in Northern Ireland because one section of the community would not accept the Royal Ulster Constabulary. In many ways, they were right not to accept them. So there's always questions about the police. The police, who will guard the guards, is a question that constantly has to be asked.
Peter, who will guard the guards?
That's a very good question. Some of the stuff that's coming out, for example, about the phone hacking has actually raised questions in people's minds in general terms about the role of the police, the linkages that some police officers have at a very senior level, you know, in the society in which they move. But it is true to say that, you know, generally speaking, British security services have paid very little attention to the extreme right. And that's a historical attitude that they've actually had. You know, going back to the 1930s, 1920s, and, you know, the Sinoviev letter and all these types of things, where the British Security Service has been, shall we say, strongly linked to some very questionable right-wing individuals and organisations. Hopefully, and I'm being careful what I say here, I might get clapped in irons as I walk out, but hopefully they're beginning to recognise that there is potentially a higher threat from elements on the right than there ever was from individuals on the left.
OK, well, looking at Norway more generally, here's Marina Morris.
Hello. UK's new record high prison population. New figures released by the Ministry of Justice show that despite government plans to cut the prison population, a record of almost 85,600 prisoners in England and Wales, plus 8,000 in Scotland and more in Northern Ireland. More than 3 in every 2,000 of our population are in jail. Following recent events in Norway, there have been many comparisons to the Norwegian prison system. Conditions in Norway's prison are regarded as more humane than in the UK. Norway has a prison population of around 3,300 of its 4.9 million citizens, less than half the imprisonment rate of the UK. Norwegian demographics are very different from the UK. There's a much smaller population living in a country a third larger than the UK. According to the IMF in 2010, Norway had the second highest GDP per capita at almost $84,500 in the world, 2.3 times the UK's average of $36,100, mainly due to oil. Norway's prison system focused on rehabilitation and reintegration of offenders into society. About 20% of prisoners released from Norwegian prisons return without 2 years, compared to between 50 and 60% in the UK, 3 times more. Like the UK, Norway's prison population is growing. There is a speculation that Breivik, the man accused of Norway's recent bombing and shooting, if convicted, will serve out his sentences and at Halden prison. Halden houses up to 252 of Norway's most dangerous prisoners, all in single cells, with an ensuite bathroom, mini fridge, flat screen TVs, bar barless windows, and even a house where prisoners can spend the night with their families. Ministers recently confirmed that 2,000 British prison cells do not have toilets. Sloping Out officially ended in 1996, when the same number of cells, around 3%, did not have toilet facilities. Norway takes the view that many prisoners are also victims. They have often been brutalized, incarcerating them in detention condition, when only dehumanize them further. As Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark attempts to cut costs by reducing the prison population, the Norwegian example shows that if you want to change behavior, you need to invest money. What do we need to decide is what we want from our prisons: rehabilitation or punishment? And can we afford not rehabilitate offenders back into society? Norway's tragedy raises many questions. On one side, it teaches us that no matter how egalitarian our society becomes, risk can never be eliminated. On other side, long term, we need to concentrate not only on punishment, but also on family values and social education, to invest time and money teaching children empathy, respect, compassion, and humane behavior.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Peter Hammond, the Labour leader, could you tell us why you think it is? Marina came up with some fascinating facts there, that we have less than half the number or rate of people in Norway are imprisoned as are in the UK. So that means, you know, twice the proportion here are incarcerated rather than Norway. And also, more interestingly, in a way, at 20% of the prisoners released from Norwegian prisons return within 2 years, compared between 50 and 60 in the UK. That's the reoffending rate is something like a third of what it is over here.
Well, I read that figure earlier in the week, and I think it's a very interesting figure, and it marks a totally different approach to, if you like, what prison is used for, because quite clearly in Norway it's regarded as a mechanism for rehabilitation, i.e. bringing people back into, if you like, into a productive relationship and back into society, whereas here, regrettably, it's still regarded simply as a means of punishment. And quite rightly, society feels that it needs to punish people that's offended against it. But on the other hand, what's the point in putting people in a building and actually, you probably actually increase the crime rate, actually, because the amount of reoffending that takes place by people that come out of prison, many of whom are in no better than when they went in, and in many cases, some cases, have actually become drug addicts whilst they've been in there, and they weren't before they went in. So there is something fundamentally wrong with the prison system that we have here. Now, I'm not a sociologist, but I do think that the approach that the Norwegians appear to have is that it's simplistically a rehabilitation process and treating people as human beings rather than simply a punishment process. And they've invested money and resources into that particular process. And as Martin was saying earlier, as a society, it's a far more stable society than possibly we've got here, and probably a far more, how could I put it, overall contented society than perhaps we've got.
But Peter, surely, I mean, for most people, it's going to really rather annoy them to hear you saying, well, we've really got to look after our prisons. We've got to make sure they've got a flat screen TV. We've got to make sure they've got all the creature comforts, a nice comfy sofa, whatever it is they want.
I wish I had a nice screen TV, because I have a second-hand one at the moment, which is rather ancient. Yes, it's difficult for us, you know, bluntly, to be able to sort of react to that. But I take it on a pragmatic basis. If it works, if we are ostensibly going to cut the crime rate, cut reoffending rates, and potentially, arguably, cut sort of drug addiction, etc., why don't we try it and see whether it works? Surely the end answer is, does it work? If it works, perhaps we should do it. If it doesn't work, then perhaps we shouldn't do it. And that's a simple, pragmatic approach to it.
I mean, if someone is, for example, homeless and committing crime, would then put them into quite a nice luxury apartment. And so for somebody who's really, like, hit rock bottom, crime is going to be the natural thing to do.
Well, that is an argument, but despite the apparent sort of luxury of the Norwegian prison system, there is actually quite an important principle at stake here, and that's the fact that even with the conditions that they've got, they are not fully part of society, and actually that's one of the penalties in any criminal system, that you actually take people out of society. And actually we're crowd animals, and actually taking us out of relationship with society actually is a punishment. Now that might sound sort of PC and trendy left, but that's the truth of it.
Well, I think also, of course, what you want your prisons to do is remove people like this individual, Behring Breivik, from society. I don't care if he watches the flat-screen TV. I just don't want him walking the streets.
Yeah,
and that's the point, is that once he's banged up somewhere, and, of course, you don't necessarily want him banged up in complete horrific circumstances, because he might just be more biddable if he can watch telly. I mean, I'd rather have him watching telly than storming around murdering people. And, of course, they shouldn't execute people like this, because there's always more information you can get from them. I don't think he should ever come out of prison, ever, frankly, somebody like this. And but at the same time, you want to keep going back and asking him again and again and again. So you were on the phone to this person from the English Defence League. We've been through your phone records. Tell us who this person is. Tell us who that person is. And, of course, if he cooperates, you then give him little privileges. And if he doesn't cooperate, you withdraw those privileges. And that's got to be... When we go for the big guys, like Murdoch could end up in prison, and the same things will happen to him and Berlusconi. They could all end up in prison. We say, right, do you want a flat-screen TV, Mr. Murdoch? Right, you better cooperate then. Oh, you don't want a flat-screen TV. That's how you deal with people like that.
OK, on to our next story. The Libyan ambassador was told to leave Britain on Wednesday, and Foreign Secretary William Hague has appointed a new ambassador who's part of the Libyan Transitional Council. Here's William Hague, Foreign Secretary, announcing the move at his press conference.
The Prime Minister and I have decided that the United Kingdom recognises and will deal with the National Transitional Council as the sole governmental authority in Libya. This decision reflects the National Transitional Council's increasing legitimacy, competence and success in reaching out to Libyans across the country.
I'm a little bit confused about just how far we're going towards recognising a different regime in Libya. As I understood, the reason we couldn't follow other countries in recognising the Benghazi-based regime was that we recognise countries, not governments. Are you saying we've gone beyond that?
On the question about the recognition of countries or states or governments, we consider this now to be a unique situation. We've not come across one of these situations before. But clearly, in dealing with the National Transitional Council as the sole governmental authority, we are dealing with them as if they were the state of Libya. And that is how we are now treating them. So it is not a fundamental change in our approach.
That was William Hague there being quizzed by Gary Gibbon from Channel 4 News. Now, a Labour leader, or leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, not quite the leader entirely yet, Peter Hammond. What are your thoughts about William Hague's move here? Because he's now decided that rather than deal with Gaddafi and the Tripoli government, he's going to be dealing with the Benghazi government.
Well, I think we've got to cut across the sort of legalistic arguments about what approach the British government is taking. The British government has decided for political reasons, with a small p, that it no longer wishes to deal with the Gaddafi government. It now wishes to deal with the other government. You can dress it up whichever way you like with legalistic phraseology. That's what they've decided to do. Some people might say, for example, in other contexts, well, why do we still recognise? We still recognise Robert Mugabe as president of Zimbabwe. There's a political decision that we've taken, despite the fact that we've criticised quite rightly the Mugabe regime, but we haven't taken a political or legalistic decision that we don't want to talk to him. We'd rather talk to somebody else. It's all to do with geopolitics and politics about, you know, oil, money, etc. And if you look at it very carefully, I think the major consideration of the British government, rightly or wrongly, is over the control of the oil resources of Libya, and they've decided that the transitional government looks like a better deal in terms of, if you like, British oil interests or international oil interests in Libya. And that's not defending in any sense or form, you know, Gaddafi's activities and the way in which he's dealt with, you know, with Libyans. But that's the reality of it, and to dress it up any other way is, you know, we're fooling people.
So was it the right thing to do?
That's very difficult to judge, actually. If you want to act in British business interests, you could say it's quite a justifiable
decision, because it also releases various financial resources that are being held by the British and other governments, etc., which they will now release to the Transitional Council. I'm not sure it is the right decision in one sense, is because I'm not convinced that the Transitional Council is a coherent body. It is, you know, still pretty chaotic. Witness the fact that somebody's just died, having been recalled back to the government. Their military commander, for some strange reason, appears to have died, having been closely guarded in a convoy with loads of guards, etc., which does raise a number of questions about the stability of the Transitional Council and what actually is going on.
OK, Martin, let's put this to you, William Hague's decision. I'll just remind you, I'm sure you know, that you were around in Yugoslavia, and, of course, one of the things that was really important at the beginning of that was the decision of several governments to recognise the KLA as in Kosovo.
In Kosovo, and also Slovenia and Croatia earlier in the conflict. I suspect that this is a very unwise decision, because it's quite clear that it's very hard sitting here in a studio in Bristol to know what Libyans think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at the beginning of the crisis, as you know, I wasn't necessarily opposed to a no-fly zone. But then I discovered through research that the French Air Force and the British Air Force have been planning a war game exactly called Operation Southern Mistral 2011. It's all on the French Air Force website, which is exactly the same as the war that's actually played out. So I began to suspect that this has all been planned in advance. And don't forget, the Islamic Fighting Group, which is based in Benghazi and is providing most of the fighters for the rebel alliance, is Al-Qaeda Libya, and have had relations with Western intelligence services going back a long way. It seems to me that Gaddafi has a degree of popular support, perhaps not in Benghazi, but certainly in Tripoli. They had a demonstration of 1.7 million people the other day. I saw the photos of it. The fact of the matter is that what I think the Russians and the Chinese, the Turks and all sort of independent people are saying is, well, let's have a ceasefire and talk about it and negotiate. And the West is saying, well, we don't want to negotiate with Gaddafi, but it's like we used to say with the IRA, we want to negotiate with the IRA, but we don't want to negotiate with Adams and McGuinness. It's silly. Gaddafi does have some popular support. It's quite clear. And that they can't just wish that away.
Well,
if he didn't have, he'd have gone by now.
He has quite a bit of support. If you see every Friday in Tripoli, there are massive demonstrations.
Well, he's actually got more support than he used to have, because he's turning into a kind of Churchill figure. We will fight them on the beaches. And his radio station is run by somebody who was opposed to him for many years and has now come over to his side because he doesn't like foreign interference. Now, I don't know. I'm not trying to second guess what Libyans should do. It's very impossible to say. But there's a lot of precipitate action gone on here. This no-fly zone turned into an intervention in the civil war, and the Russians and the Chinese were very annoyed about that. A no-fly zone's a no-fly zone. It's not a license to go around bombing anything you like. And they've been attacking all sorts of things. I noticed that you've got another thing here about them attacking the Libyans' water supply.
Well, I was rather frustrated to see William Hague talking about how important it is to look after the oil supplies to the rebels, who are having all sorts of trouble with their oil supply, whilst actually bombing the water supplies in and around Tripoli, which seems a bit hypocritical.
Well, what they're trying to do is force the civilian population to turn on Gaddafi because of the miserable nature of their conditions. But that never works. It didn't work in Iraq. It didn't work in Britain during World War II. The Luftwaffe just made people more determined to fight on.
Well,
I'm afraid the NATO campaign has killed an awful lot of people, and it's actually turned them against NATO. It's silliness, really.
Now, as for efforts for peace, I know there was a bunch of Islamic imams who were doing their best this week to actually get talks going between the rebels and Gaddafi.
Well, they've been to see Gaddafi. They were heading off to see the Benghazi government, and then they were having lunch, and they were in the cafe where they were having lunch. It was hit by a NATO bomb, and they were all killed apart from one guy. Now, I don't know. This is war, and both sides are lying. There's lots of misinformation and disinformation being chucked out. But I think it's quite clear that British public opinion is very dubious about this intervention. Very dubious.
OK, so let's now hear William Hague's talking about the way that he is planning to look after the rebels with financial support, which was actually money which was seized at the beginning of this crisis back in March.
At the request of the Arabian Gulf Oil Company, a Libyan oil company, the United Kingdom is ready to make available £91 million of the company's assets in the United Kingdom. This company is operating under the control of the NTC, and we are assured that its activities will not benefit any listed entity under the sanctions. We will issue licenses for the use of its frozen funds to meet basic needs in Libya. This will help to ensure that the crucial provision of fuel is maintained. We will work hard with our international partners in the coming weeks to unfreeze further Libyan assets frozen in the United Kingdom for the benefit of the Libyan people, including stocks of Libyan currency and other assets of the Libyan Central Bank.
Now, Martin, it seems pretty clear what's going on there is that the British Foreign Secretary is saying, well, actually, this money that we seized at the beginning of the conflict now is going to be used to aid the rebels, and at least to try and get the economy going. So that's what he's talking about. He's saying, look, we're not just going to give the money to the rebels, but we want actually economic activity, and we want the east of Libya to start returning to normal.
Well, I mean, the partition of Libya looks very likely at this stage of the game, doesn't it? Let's face it.
Am I right in thinking that actually, originally, before the Second World War, and if you go back sort of 80 years or something, that Libya did have a line which was drawn down? It was two separate countries.
Well, there were three separate provinces in the Ottoman Empire originally, but nevertheless, Libya became a unitary state as a result of pressure from the, because they were all occupied by Italy, and there was a massive fight against the Italians, and when the Italians were kicked out, the Libyan unitary state was created. I think I'm loath to come up with solutions to this crisis sitting here in a studio in Bristol, but what I do know from my experiences of war, like in for example in former Yugoslavia, is that talking to people is always more sensible than trying to crush them because you can't accept their point of view. There are Libyans in Bristol who support the rebels. There are others who support Gaddafi. I've met both, and I think it's just wrong. I mean, Gaddafi has been demonised, and we're now saying, well, he's got to go, and that military action against him is justified, including trying to kill his children. Don't forget, his grandchildren have been killed. And I would say, well, of course, military action against King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and the King of Bahrain is obviously justified, and because they are clearly, you know, monarchs with children who might take over, the children are clearly targets, and their allies. So that means Cameron is a legitimate target. If I was a Bahraini revolutionary, I'd say, well, clearly Cameron's a legitimate target, and his children. Now, Britain doesn't quite realise what doors they are opening here. Yeah. Now, if we're going to say that armed revolution is justified, well, it's justified against everybody, not just against Gaddafi. So let's get ready for the armed revolution, shall we? Now, of course, we don't want to talk about armed revolution, do we? Only when it suits us. And I think it's pretty disgusting that people who sit in comfort in a comfortable country are making a hell out of Libya. Maybe they need their kids bombed as well.
Well, let's hope not. Calm down there,
Martin. No, it just angers me. It just angers me.
Peter, what are your thoughts about this whole business of the financial side of this? Because it looks as if this is a kind of form of economic warfare. What they're doing is they're saying, we're not going to be giving the seized assets back to everybody in Libya. We're only going to be giving them back to the rebel side. So they're really, I mean, they've clearly taken sides big time here. Do you think that's the right thing to do?
Well, presumably they've got some sort of assessment that they've decided that... in terms of economic advantage, and it has to be. And now the British government is quite clear about it, is that they're after, you know, what they perceive to be the economic advantage, if you like, of Britain. And they've done a calculation that, say, to me, that seems to suggest by releasing these resources that actually Britain will benefit as a result of this process, whether it's reinvigorating the economy in the east of Libya or whatever it is. And there are lots of suggestions about, you know, the fact that oil production has suffered, obviously, during the course of this conflict, and that is a major concern for British companies. Now, we're told with whatever that company was is, you know, run by legitimate and recognised and reputable people, but if you delve down in its ownership and the deals that it's got, you'll probably find that a lot of the oil that potentially they could be producing would be sold to British and American commercial interests. So we've got to be honest and open about it, and, you know, and be straightforward. It's not a consideration about what is beneficial necessarily for people in Libya. And you really, really have to sort of recognise this. But Britain has a long history of involvement with what we used to call the Arab world, which includes Libya, Egypt, across into Saudi Arabia. And it used to be sort of part of the, if not actually technically part of the British Empire, it was part of Britain's sphere of influence.
Bahrain was part of the British Empire till 1971.
I bow to your superior knowledge. But yeah, that's where it is, and that's where economic interests are perceived to be.
Okay, what about Martin's little angry session he had just now? The anger. Do you feel anger that Colonel Gaddafi's son and three of his grandchildren have been killed by NATO? And do you think that is actually kind of encouraging repercussions? That is to say, potentially the Libyans may decide that they want to attack our politicians and our leaders.
It's a troubled subject, really. I might not get perhaps as worked up as Martin obviously demonstrated just then, but if you start to, if you like, encourage assassination, whether it's by a sniper's bullet or whether it's by a bomb that falls from an aeroplane, you will reap the reward from doing that yourselves. And that's been the problem in terms of all the conflicts that have existed. But an interesting point is that I think the last sort of big conflict which ended in somebody, if you like, being beaten into the ground militarily was at the end of the Second World War. All the other conflicts that have existed since that Second World War have ended up with people talking to each other, and that's really the secret. Ultimately, people have to talk to each other, and that's what's resolved conflicts since that particular point in time.
Martin, at the risk of inflaming your anger again, do you think there really is any prospect for peace in Libya?
Yes.
Because at the moment, it doesn't seem so. I mean, what William Hague is announcing this week is actually very much a one-sided thing. It's not being even-handed with both sides, and also that NATO have said that they're going to be fighting in there certainly at least until the middle or end of September.
Well, they can count the fight as long as they like. I mean, Gaddafi is sitting tight, and basically, frankly, he is winning, as the resistance in Afghanistan is winning and as the Iranians are winning in Iraq.
I mean,
they're losing all three wars. Isn't that great?
In a high-tech war, surely, ultimately, it is going to be possible at some point for...
No, they don't understand modern warfare. Hezbollah in southern Lebanon has got 3,500 effective fighters. And in 2006, they trashed the Israeli army, which is the fourth biggest in the world, has got all the latest kit. The problem with the people driving our policy is that they're not soldiers, they're arms dealers. And they think that if we've got all the kit, then it's just simple. We just press a button, it costs millions, but we're bound to win. And in actual fact, they've lost, as they lost in Vietnam. The Americans haven't won a war since 1945. They've had to negotiate every time. Peter is quite right there. And ultimately, that is the 21st century. Basically, it's much easier for people, the underdog, to win, and therefore everything has to be negotiated. And there's been an imperial arrogance about Britain's approach to all of this that sickens me, especially when I discovered that there was a whole plan in advance. People can check this, just do a computer search. Operation Southern Mistral 2011 has been up on the French Air Force website since last November, therefore it's been planned since last March, and it's exactly what's happened. So this rebellion in eastern Libya looks as if it was coordinated. It wasn't spontaneous.
Peter, just before we come up to the 6 o'clock news, can you just give us in a nutshell as you're the leader of the Labour group on the council, what is Labour's vision for the city?
Labour's vision for the city is something that is perhaps different from the moment. We're actually interested in people's inspiration. We're interested in culture. And we're interested in the key thing is creativity. Bristolians, wherever you come from, Bristolian by birth, Bristolian by invitation, is tremendously creative. And what we've got to do is unleash that creativity amongst people, and we've got to look about working together. So that's, in a nutshell, where we think we're going. We're not going in that direction.
Well, it's easy to say, but how are you going to do it? I mean, we're in, now we've, you know, the Liberal Democrats are doing their best, but cuts and budget deficit. Surely the first thing to go is going to be the creative arts, isn't it?
It's not simply about what conventionally is called the creative arts, if you like. You can go anywhere in Bristol. A Pigeon Fanciers Club is a creative organisation because it's people coming together doing something that they believe in, and they are working together. That's the sort of creativity
I'm interested
in.
Sounds like the big society, Peter.
Yes,
very different.
Maybe you're a closet conservative, Peter.
Whoa.
I'll come back for another hour and talk about that.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks to this week's guest. That was leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council and councillor for St George West, and that's Peter Hammond. After the news, this show's always fishing around for corruption, so the News of the World phone hacking crimes have opened a can of worms for us. The criminal conspiracy between News International, allegedly, and Scotland Yard is at the heart of government and now plain to see, while the perpetrators remain at large. We talked to two authors who've been digging out stories about corruption in Scotland Yard for the last 10 years after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.